Hi, welcome to the Growth.me book summary of Behave by Robert Sapolsky. Behave explains why humans behave the way we do. Sapolsky breaks down complex science into enjoyable explanations, beginning at the level of our brains, then diving into hormones, genes, evolution, and even culture and history. By the end, you'll be questioning many long-held assumptions about how much we control ourselves. Top quote from this book is, "Crucially, the brain region most involved in feeling afraid and anxious is most involved in generating aggression," end quote. And that would be the amygdala, which we'll talk about very soon. Let's begin. As Abraham Maslow said, when a man has a hammer, then everything begins to look like a nail. And this couldn't be more true than when we're looking at the science behind human behaviors. For any one question, the experts from every discipline will give you a different answer. For example, ask a biologist what causes aggression, and they might tell you genes or hormones. Ask a psychologist, and they might say early childhood experiences or a maladaptive way of thinking. Ask a sociologist, and they might start talking about the cultural, political, and religious structures that shape people. In other words, it's complicated. And this is a theme that runs throughout this book. Robert Sapolsky, who's a professor of biology and neurology at Stanford University, is very much aware of the buckets that even great experts like himself can become stuck in. Here's a quote from the book. "When you think categorically, you have trouble seeing how similar or different two things are. If you pay lots of attention to where boundaries are, you pay less attention to complete pictures," end quote. So this book explains human behavior not just with neurons or not just with hormones, but also through psychology, evolution, culture, and history. In doing this, Sapolsky tries to create a more accurate picture of why we do what we do without getting stuck into the tunnel vision of one particular academic discipline. So keep this in mind as you're listening to this note, that there are multiple lenses through which we can look at human behavior, and none of them are really right or wrong because they're all intertwined, and human behavior is usually caused by multiple things interacting in complicated ways. Here's another quote. "What occurred in the prior second that triggered the behavior? This is the province of the nervous system. What occurred in the prior seconds to minutes that triggered the nervous system to produce that behavior? This is the world of sensory stimuli, much of it sensed unconsciously. What occurred in the prior hours to days to change the sensitivity of the nervous system to such stimuli? Acute actions of hormones. And so on, all the way back to the evolutionary pressures played out over the prior millions of years that started the ball rolling," end quote. And that's the basic structure of this book. It starts with what's closest to us, which is the firing of our neurons, and gradually works its way back through hormones, brain development, childhood experiences, genetics, culture, and evolution. So the first big lesson from this book is the triune brain model. Your brain is part reptilian, part emotional, and part neocortex. So to understand how the human brain works as a whole in a big picture way, there's a very useful idea called the triune brain model. This model was created in the 1960s by a neuroscientist, Paul McLean, and it states that our brains have roughly three layers. First, we have the reptilian brain. This is the innermost core of our brain, and it resembles the way that reptile brains work. In fact, mammals evolved from reptiles about 300 million years ago, and this part of the brain is responsible for our body's automatic or autonomic functions like breathing, heart rate, and body temperature. Now, second, wrapped around the reptilian brain is the emotional brain. It is also called the paleomammalian brain or limbic system. This part controls our emotions like anger and fear, social bonding, parenting, and so on. Other mammals like dogs, for example, also have this emotional layer of the brain, which is why we can understand when dogs feel sad or happy, and vice versa. And finally, we have the neocortex, wrapped, at the outermost layer. And evolutionary speaking, this is the newest part of our brain, responsible for abstract thinking, math, memory, language, music, long-term planning, and so on. Other mammals like primates and dolphins also do have a neocortex, but it's uniquely large in humans. Okay, so it's important to understand that this model is not strictly accurate. It's more of a useful metaphor that helps us to organize and make sense of the brain. And even the creator of this model understood that. You see, in reality, the brain is too complicated to cleanly divide into three parts. But nonetheless, it is roughly true that humans' brains evolved this way, from primitive survival drives to emotions to abstract thoughts. And now let's take a deeper look at what the individual parts of the brains are, of our brains are, and what they do. Okay, so summary of this first lesson, the triune brain model is a useful metaphor to help us organize our understanding of the brain. The innermost layer is our reptilian brain, which controls automatic body functions, then we have the emotion or mammalian brain, and then the neocortex, which does advanced and abstract thinking. Now lesson two, the amygdala, your brain's center of fear, anxiety, and aggression. When you're walking outside and suddenly you jump 2 feet in the air because you mistook your water hose for a snake, well, that's your amygdala doing its thing. The amygdala, which consists of two small almond-shaped clusters in your brain, is crucial in making us feel fear and anxiety. And one important job of the amygdala is to trigger the fight or flight response when there is a threat nearby. So you see a snake, or you think you see one, and a cocktail of chemicals including adrenaline and cortisone are released in your body designed to help you to run away or to overcome the threat. This is designed by nature to be a short-term response, shutting off when we've reached a place of safety. But if our amygdala is constantly being triggered by the wrong things, this can lead to chronic stress, which can seriously deteriorate health. And we modern humans are constantly stressed out because our amygdala is being triggered by sort of imaginary threats that there is no running away from. Like, you can't run away from your mortgage and taxes. And also interesting, in people with PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, you know, like soldiers coming back from a war, the amygdala has become much more sensitive to mildly fearful things. And over the long term, the amygdala even increases in size in people who have PTSD, phobias, or anxiety disorders. Okay, now let's talk about how aggression is linked to the amygdala. And this brings us back to that top quote we mentioned at the beginning. Here's the quote. Crucially, the brain region most involved in feeling afraid and anxious is most involved in generating aggression. End quote. So aside from fear, the amygdala has another surprising link, aggression. Stimulating someone's amygdala with an electrode seems to trigger sudden anger and aggression. Some people have a rare type of epilepsy where their seizures cause physical aggression, and surgeons have tried removing the amygdala in some of those cases, and much of the aggression associated with the seizures went away. In fact, in a darker chapter of medical history, some people who had no seizures but just exhibited quote-unquote overly aggressive behavior also had their amygdala removed, which afterward raised huge ethical questions. And the results for those operations were mixed, but with some anecdotal claims of decreased aggression. Now, since we can clearly link the amygdala to aggression and certain diseases can affect the amygdala, this brings up big questions for the whole sort of logic underneath our justice system. And I'll share with you a story from the book. On the first day of August in 1966, Charlie Whitman stabbed his wife and mother, then went to the top of University of Texas Tower and used a rifle to kill 17 people and wound 31 others. And the strangest part of this event was that for most of his life, Charlie was always known as a bright and intelligent person. He had an IQ of 138, putting him in the 99th percentile. And as a child, there was never any real signs of aggression. He was an Eagle Scout and had a newspaper route. Later, he's working at the bank, and his supervisor described him as a truly outstanding person, very likable, neat, nice-looking, a great guy. But then, sometime during his university studies, everything began to change for Charlie. He started complaining of big headaches, he began having angry outbursts at the slightest provocation, and he could feel that something was wrong with him, so he began writing extensive journal notes with many entries in his journal, urging him to control his temper or expressing deep remorse for his latest outburst, like when he threw a classmate out the door in anger. He began to overeat and became overweight. He wasn't able to sleep for days at a time. In his journal, he wrote, quote, "I do not really understand myself these days. I am supposed to be an average, reasonable, and intelligent young man. However, lately, I cannot recall when it started. I have been a victim of many unusual and irrational thoughts," end quote. And then a week before the shooting, he went to see a school psychiatrist who described him as oozing with hostility, and Charlie expressed to the psychiatrist his concern with his temper and vividly described shooting people from the tower. And then a few days later, in his suicide note, he donated his assets to mental health foundations, and he asked for an autopsy to be done on his brain to check if there was a biological problem, as he suspected. And when the autopsy was done, they found a walnut-sized tumor pressing into his amygdala. So, did his tumor cause the strange behavior and eventually the shooting? Well, not exactly, although there is every reason to suspect that it had a large effect on his personality and the tragic outcome of his life. So, maybe not causing it, but having a big influence on what happened. And, well, by the way, in this story, there are a few important details left out, like how he joined the army to escape an abusive dad, and how he did have, like, other sort of outbursts in the army. So, you know, there were other environmental influences that definitely played a part, too. Now, here's a summary of this lesson. The amygdala, the size of two almonds in our brain, plays a key role in fears, phobias, anxieties, and the fight or flight response. Now, stress is when our fight or flight response is constantly being triggered by the wrong things, like a mortgage and taxes, and it can have very negative long-term effects on our health. The amygdala is also crucial in generating aggression. And now lesson three, the frontal cortex, the adult in the room. Located just behind our foreheads is the newest and shiniest part of our brains called the frontal cortex. It's newest in terms of having evolved most recently. The frontal cortex is responsible for long-term planning, strategic decisions, regulating emotions, resisting impulses, and more. Robert Sapolsky summarizes it like this, quote, "The frontal cortex makes you do the harder thing when it's the right thing to do," end quote. In the 1960s, Walter Mischel of Stanford devised a now-famous experiment called the Marshmallow Test, designed to test kids' willpower. Here's how it worked. Kids were sat individually in front of a table with a marshmallow on a plate in front of them, and they were told by the researcher that the researcher would leave and come back in 15 minutes, and if the kid wanted to, they could eat the marshmallow, but if they could resist the temptation until the researcher came back in 15 minutes, then they would get an extra marshmallow. And what happened? Well, a few kids ate the marshmallow right away. The average time was 11 minutes for how long they could resist eating it, and about one-third of the kids lasted to the end of 15 minutes. But the researchers didn't stop there. They followed up with the kids years and decades later, and the results astounded them. It turns out the kids who were better at resisting the marshmallow, signaling better self-control and therefore prefrontal cortex regulation, later in life they had better SAT scores, more social success, and resilience. And even 40 years later, they had lower body mass index and more prefrontal cortex activation during a challenging task inside a brain scanner. Wow. So the prefrontal cortex, which is all about long-term planning and delaying gratification, seems to play a large role in life success. But don't worry, it's not just a genetic talent. These researchers found that some kids were better at resisting the marshmallow because they used better mental strategies, like thinking about something else, or putting a frame around the marshmallow, pretending it was a picture rather than a real marshmallow. And teaching these kinds of strategies to other kids boosted their willpower too. Let's return to the topic of aggression, because the frontal cortex seems to play a role in regulating aggression too. A 2007 review paper from the University of Ohio said, In humans, many studies have reported a link between brain damage to the frontal cortex and increased aggressive behavior. These findings are consistent with reports that individuals who rank highly on measures of reactive aggression show lower than average baseline activity in the frontal cortex, end quote. So that's very interesting. So if the amygdala is where aggression is generated, it seems like the frontal cortex is where aggressive impulses are later inhibited and attempted to be regulated. In fact, the most common therapy for both anger and anxiety issues is cognitive behavioral therapy, which teaches people new ways of interpreting and processing life situations. It seems to be a way of using the rational reasoning of the frontal cortex to retrain the amygdala. All right, so a summary of this idea: the frontal cortex, which is located just behind your forehead, is used for strategic decisions, long-term planning, emotion regulation, impulse control, etc. A famous study found that kids who could better resist a marshmallow for 15 minutes, signaling more frontal cortex activity, later got higher SAT scores and more general life success even decades later. Now, brain damage or decreased activity in this part of the brain is linked to more aggressive behavior. Now let's go to lesson number 4, neurons and brain development, which is also why teens do dumb things. Out of all the animals, humans take an incredibly long time to fully develop outside the womb. Animals in Africa must be on their feet and walking with the herd within minutes of being born, or else they won't survive. Yet in most human societies, people aren't really responsible for themselves until they're 18 and move to college. Why such a long time? Well, that's how long it takes for a human to get at least semi-adjusted to whatever society they live in. Human societies contain incredibly complex rules, norms, and demands. It takes no time at all for a squirrel to learn how to find nuts, but it can take decades for a human to learn how to be a software engineer. In fact, the human brain itself doesn't really set until the mid-20s, and that's when it starts to resemble the brain that someone will carry into their adult life. We'll talk more in a minute about what happens in the brain during the shift from adolescence to adulthood, but first, let's take a minute to talk about how brain neurons work at the most basic level. So, how is it possible that we can learn or remember anything at all? Well, let's start at the very most basic level, neurons. Neurons are cells in your brain, and they're a special kind of cell that can communicate to each other. Now, they don't touch each other directly, but there are chemical messengers called neurotransmitters. And when one neuron becomes excited enough, which means if its inner electrical charge becomes positive rather than negative, then it will release these neurotransmitters into a small gap between neurons called a synapse. And then the ears of the next neuron will hear the message, they'll get the message, and then, you know, that will make the next neuron more excited also. And if it gets excited enough, then it will in turn send a message with neurotransmitters to the next neurons that it's connected to, and on and on and on and on and on. They're all the neurons are interconnected like this. And that's the most basic explanation of neurons, the synapses that connect them and the neurotransmitters that allow them to communicate. Of course, if you spend any time at all looking at brain science in more detail, you'll quickly find endless complications to what was just said. In fact, there are more than 86 billion neurons in our brains, each one connected with up to 10,000 other neurons. So it's a hurricane of activity happening all the time. Now, for a long time, scientists thought that when we learn something new, then new neurons must be created in our brains. Or at least there are new synapses or connections that are being created between the neurons in our brain. Intuitively, that makes sense. You learn a new memory, you create a new neuron. But it turns out not to be true at all. In 1949, the Canadian psychologist Donald Hebb published a super influential book called The Organization of Behavior that proposed a different theory. This theory became a foundation for modern psychology, and Hebb said that neurons remember things not by forming new connections, but by strengthening their existing connections. It's like walking down a forest trail. The more times someone walks down it, the more clearly defined it becomes. And that's why you'll remember a book much better if you read it twice rather than just once. And this theory has often been summarized as neurons that fire together, wire together. Now let's talk about longer-term learning and brain development. In general, as we get older, we seem to get more self-control, we learn more knowledge and wisdom, so does it make sense to assume that our brains must, you know, get larger or grow over time? Nope, we actually have more neurons in early adolescence, and then it's all downhill from there. Well, not exactly. The teenage brain does have more neurons, but they are unorganized, uncoordinated, and inefficient. Sort of like teenagers. But as we become adults, our brains go through a kind of evolution where unnecessary neurons are pruned, while at the same time, the right connections between our neurons are being strengthened, so learning is happening. And this is a situation where less is more. Less neurons, but better connections results in a more efficient brain. And this evolution is supercharged by a process called myelination. You see, through adolescence, certain connections between neurons are coated in something called myelin, and this helps the neurons communicate in a more fast and efficient way. Myelination is most effective when neuron connections stretch a long way, so it's really good at helping distant parts of the brain communicate with each other. By the way, this brain pruning idea isn't 100% true, because even into adulthood, some new neurons are always being formed in our brains through a process called neurogenesis. For example, in the hippocampus region of the brain, about 3% of neurons are replaced each month, and this process is encouraged by activities like exercise and learning, but inhibited by certain stressors. One famous study looked at people who passed the notoriously difficult London taxi driver exam. Studying for this test can take 2 to 3 years and requires you to memorize 25,000 streets plus 20,000 landmarks and business locations. It's extremely difficult. And the researchers found that people who passed the exam had developed a larger hippocampus than the average person. Right, now let's talk about more about teenagers and adolescents. Now, it's measured that young people are more risk-taking and novelty-seeking than adults. Well, no surprise there. As adolescents, most of us are itching to get out of the house. We crave new stimulation in the form of music, movies, travel, and other experiences. And part of this novelty seeking seems to have something to do with dopamine, which we'll talk more about later. But the studies are conflicted whether young people's dopamine response is more or less sensitive than adults. Also, the last part of our brains to mature is the prefrontal cortex, which again helps to regulate emotions and impulses. Well, then it's no wonder that young people are more likely to act on impulse with less consideration of long-term consequences. And surprisingly, this late prefrontal cortex development may also explain peer pressure. In studies of peer pressure, teenagers are more susceptible to it, with people 18 and older being less affected by others egging them on. Well, how would that change happen? Well, some studies have looked at how facial emotions are processed differently in adults versus adolescents. And for example, when adults look at a fearful face, first their amygdala activates, but then their prefrontal cortex activates to decrease their emotional response. But in younger people, the prefrontal cortex activation is much weaker, so they're probably feeling the emotional reactions of other people more strongly. Naomi Eisenberger of UCLA developed a really cool Cyber Bowl study where people lie in a brain scanner while playing a virtual game. And in the game, the person being studied believes that they're tossing a ball between two other people. But actually, the two other players in the game aren't really people. They're secretly part of the computer program, and the program is designed to mimic experiences of social exclusion. So here's what happens. At first, the three players in the game are throwing the ball to each other equally. But soon, the two other players stop throwing the ball to the person, the real person being studied in the brain scanner, and this makes the person feel rejected. And what happens when the person feels rejected in the brain is very interesting. There is activation in parts of the brain having to do with pain, anger, and disgust, like the amygdala and insular cortex. But very quickly, the ventrolateral prefrontal cortex, that frontal cortex part, activates and dampens those reactions. Inside the person's head, this probably looks like them saying to themselves, "Why am I caring about this game so much? It's not important enough to get upset about." But when this kind of rejection happens to adolescents, the prefrontal cortex doesn't activate as much, which means that getting rejected hurts them a lot more, like physically. So in summary, more than other animals, humans take a long time to fully develop, and human brains don't really set until the mid-20s. Learning happens not by forming new neurons or connections, but by strengthening the existing connections between neurons. And as we become adults, our brains lose unneeded neurons, but become far more efficient and well-coordinated. Adolescents may be more risk-taking, novelty-seeking, and affected by peer pressure because of differences in dopamine and a prefrontal cortex that can't yet effectively regulate emotional impulses and social feedback. All right, now on to lesson 5, which is dopamine, or why we do everything. So inside the brain, one of those neurotransmitters that our neurons use to talk to each other is called dopamine. And there are actually 4 pathways in our brain that make up what scientists call our dopamine reward system. It's what makes us feel really good when we do certain things. And in fact, this might be why we do most actions in the first place, the fundamental source of our motivation. So for example, eating food when hungry releases dopamine in the brains of most animal species, and so does having sex. In fact, humans only need to think about sex to trigger dopamine release. So understanding dopamine is critical to understanding human moods and motivations. Dopamine signaling is suppressed during depression by stress chemicals and during anxiety by amygdala projections. And now let's talk about some interesting sort of quirks or details that scientists have discovered in how dopamine works. First, the amount of dopamine released in our brains is directly related to our expectations. So for example, if your pet dog is used to getting one treat as a reward, then giving it 2 treats will make it ecstatic. That's because it's getting a huge surge of dopamine in its brain upon seeing the extra large reward. But the opposite is also true. Getting a smaller reward than we expected results in a measly dopamine release. So if your dog is used to always getting 2 treats, and today you only give it 1, then it may look at you kind of disappointed. And what about if we get exactly the reward we expected? Well, then there's not that much dopamine either. And this is the common experience we all have of getting bored with something, whether that be a video game or a particular dessert that we loved. Here's a quote. "What was an unexpected pleasure yesterday is what we feel entitled to today and what won't be enough tomorrow." End quote. They did some studies with monkeys and raisins. They taught monkeys that pressing a lever 10 times earns them a raisin reward. And at first, the scientists found that dopamine was released in the monkey brains when they got the raisins. But then something surprising happened. After the monkeys did it a few times, you know, press the lever, and they learned to expect the raisin reward, then the timing of the dopamine release changed. And they start to get a big dopamine release just before they began pressing the lever, in anticipation of getting the reward. What does that mean? Well, scientists think dopamine serves as a key fuel that motivates animals to act, and similar studies have been done with humans anticipating a monetary reward. Here's a quote. "In other words, dopamine is not about the happiness of reward, it's about the happiness of pursuit of reward that has a decent chance of occurring." End quote. So dopamine, after some learning happens, dopamine is less about the reward and more about us released during the moment we can anticipate the reward. There was another interesting twist with these monkey raisin studies. When the scientists changed the raisin reward to only be given 50% of the time instead of all the time when the lever was pushed, guess what happened? Well, then far more dopamine was then released in the monkeys' brains. This doesn't really make sense. The reward became inconsistent, but dopamine shot through the roof. But it doesn't make sense, but it might explain why gambling is so addictive. The gambler is only rewarded by winning once in a while, but inside their brains must be flooded with dopamine every time they make a bet or pull the slot machine lever. The intermittent reward spikes dopamine much more than a consistent reward. So in summary of this lesson, the dopamine reward system in our brains is why we feel great when we eat food, have sex, or play video games, for example. The amount of dopamine released in our brains is directly tied to our expectations. So getting a bigger reward than expected results in a much higher spike of dopamine, but it also means that we quickly get bored with an old reward that merely meets our expectations. When we learn that a behavior leads to a reward, then dopamine starts getting released before we act, not after we get the reward. And this must be a key to motivation. Now we have lesson 6. It's all about hormones, how testosterone, oxytocin, and stress affect us. Hormones are chemical messengers released from glands throughout our body and influence many things like mood, hunger, reproductive systems, and so on. Let's look at testosterone first. As most of us can probably guess, testosterone is higher in males and females in nearly all species, and testosterone is closely linked to aggression. For example, in prisoners, the higher the level of testosterone, the higher the level of aggression. And this is probably part of the reason why in every human culture and most animal species, males carry out most of the aggression and violence. However, the truth is not as simple as testosterone equals aggression. A 1977 study gave testosterone to groups of male talapoined monkeys, and it was found that testosterone only exaggerated pre-existing patterns of aggression rather than creating new ones. So, for example, a middle-ranking monkey who was given testosterone wouldn't begin fighting the alpha males. He would just hassle the monkeys below him more often. And testosterone also increased aggression specifically during times of challenge, like when a restless, young, confident monkey tries to take the leadership spot from the current grizzled gray alpha. Testosterone can also decrease feelings of fear and is also responsible for more impulsivity and risk-taking behavior by decreasing activity in the prefrontal cortex and its connection to the amygdala. For example, in one study found that men with higher than average testosterone levels, they engaged in 13% more financial risk-taking in an investment game. Testosterone is also closely related to status-seeking behaviors. There was a study done where male skateboarders were asked to do tricks in front of either a male researcher or an attractive female one, and you can probably guess what happened. In front of an attractive female, the skateboarders attempted riskier stunts and had more successes, but also more crash landings. And testosterone levels were measured to be significantly higher in the skateboarders in the presence of the attractive women, strongly suggesting that testosterone was mediating that risk-taking behavior. So it's entirely possible that these risky displays of physical strength, daring, health, and vigor actually evolved as ways to entice potential mates and discourage potential rivals and or challengers. Here's another quote from the book. Testosterone makes us more willing to do what it takes to attain and maintain status. And the key point is what it takes. Engineer social circumstances right, and boosting testosterone levels during a challenge would make people compete like crazy to do the most acts of random kindness. In our world riddled with male violence, the problem isn't that testosterone can increase levels of aggression. The problem is the frequency with which we reward aggression. End quote. All right, so now let's switch to oxytocin. Now, this hormone picked up the groovy nickname the love hormone because it's often linked to sort of connection and pro-social behavior. Oxytocin is released when romantic partners hold hands, for example, when they hug and during sexual activity. It seems to facilitate trust and bonding. Female mammals generally have higher levels of oxytocin than males, and it's strongly connected to maternal behavior. So, for example, oxytocin is released in high amounts during pregnancy, preparing the body for birth and lactation. If a female virgin rat is given oxytocin, she will begin acting maternally, even picking up and grooming kids that aren't hers. But when oxytocin is blocked in the brain of a rodent mother, then maternal behaviors, including nursing, stop. In human mothers and infants, oxytocin is crucially important for bonding. Women touch their babies and eye gaze with them more when they have genes for higher oxytocin levels or receptors. Now, oxytocin might be related to encouraging monogamy too. And this was shown in one study where men were given either oxytocin or a placebo spread up their nose, and then they were asked to rate the attractiveness of both their partner and unfamiliar woman. And the men under the subtle influence of oxytocin rated their partner as more attractive. Another experiment gave oxytocin to men in stable relationships and found they spent less time looking at photos of attractive women. Not that they rated the woman as less attractive, they just were less interested. They spent less time looking at the photos. Yet another experiment found that when you give oxytocin to guys in relationships, they sat 4 to 6 inches further away from a female researcher, an effect that wasn't seen for guys who were single or when the researcher was male. However, it's not all positive. Studies have also found that, quote, oxytocin promotes human ethnocentrism. In other words, it makes people more favorable to those who are seen as part of their own group and more derogatory or biased against those outside the group. So oxytocin may have played a role in human violence and wars in the past, not just love. Now let's talk about stress hormones, which are called glucocorticoids. So when we talked about the amygdala, we've already covered a little bit about the flight or fright response and how that can turn into chronic stress. Again, when stress is a short-term response, it can be very useful. It can help you run away from a bear or a knife-wielding maniac. But in many ways, modern life has hijacked this fight or flight response, and now our stress response is triggered by many things which are not an immediate survival threat, like taxes and traffic. More importantly, you can't run away from these, which means there's no relief or release from the stress hormones. And when the stress chemicals, also called glucocorticoids, stay in your body in the long term, they can be very damaging to health. They sap our immune system, increase vulnerability to sickness and infection, increase risk of high blood pressure and diabetes. Stress makes it harder for your prefrontal cortex to regulate your amygdala, making it harder to unlearn irrational fears. And not only do high stress hormone levels appear to impair working memory, but they suppress other higher brain functions also. So when you're stressed, you get sick more easily, and you can't think straight. Stress also has another connection. It's highly related to status and social subordination. In rodents and baboons, the lower an individual is on the social hierarchy, the higher their resting levels of the stress hormones or glucocorticoids are. And this translates to all kinds of negative health effects, like we just mentioned. But as baboons rise in the hierarchy, they tend to have lower levels of stress hormones. But with one big exception, the alpha male at the top has very high stress levels, as high as the lowest ranking baboon. Why? Well, it's probably because the single male at the top has to spend much of his time fighting and defending his sexual partnerships, which must be very stressful. In humans, we often assume that, you know, the overworked executives must be the most stressed, let's say. But in fact, it's been measured that middle managers are even more stressed than executives, perhaps because they carry a lot of responsibility combined with little control, which might mimic the learned helplessness of depression. Stress also leads to more displacement aggression. And this means that in many species, animals will hit those who are subordinate to them if they have high stress hormone levels. So, for example, in baboons, about 50% of aggressive behaviors fit this category. And the worst part is that it often works. Displacement aggression often does decrease an animal's stress levels. And a dark statistic related to this is that rates of spouse and child abuse increase during economic downturns. So, in summary of this lesson about hormones, testosterone increases aggression, but usually by exaggerating already existing patterns of aggression rather than creating new ones. It also increases impulsivity, risk-taking, and status-driven behaviors. Oxytocin facilitates trust and bonding between lovers, between mothers and children, and probably encourages monogamy, but it can also increase ethnocentric bias too. Chronic stress, which is a perversion of the fight or flight response, over the long term, it can be very damaging to our health and brain function. And in general, animals with lower social status have higher stress hormone levels. And now to lesson 7, childhood, the early influence of parents and environment. Even before we're born, our parents and environment are already begin influencing our development. How? Well, during pregnancy, we're directly connected to our mother for 9 months, and it's not just food and nutrients that are passing through the umbilical cord. For example, when a pregnant woman is stressed, the glucocorticoid stress hormones will also pass through to the fetus, producing a brain more sensitive to triggers of depression and anxiety, even into adulthood. In 1944, near the end of World War II, the Netherlands was being occupied by Nazi forces, which caused the Dutch people to endure a terrible famine called the Dutch Hunger Winter. More than 20,000 people died, but the most surprising result is that decades later, effects of the famine still echo inside Dutch people's genes. Women who were pregnant during the famine gave birth to babies that later in life were more likely to have obesity, diabetes, and schizophrenia. They also died more easily or at a higher rate than other people. And this event really illustrated for scientists the powerful influence of a person's environment even before birth. Now, what about after birth? Well, for a long time, people had the misguided notion that an infant is a biological machine, and as long as it has enough food, water, and shelter, then it'll grow up fine. And that's why before the 1950s, many hospitals that kept sick kids long-term only allowed parents to visit rarely and for a short time. See, they thought presence of family was considered an unnecessary distraction. But during those times, hospitalized kids were also dying in droves from infections and illnesses unrelated to why they came to the hospital in the first place. Back then, people had no idea that maternal deprivation could have such a strong effect on kids, causing hopelessness and easier susceptibility to death. And then, in the 1950s, the psychiatrist John Bowlby developed theories around mother-infant attachment that still remain foundational to modern psychology. And he proposed the radical idea that infants need love, care, and attention to survive and thrive, not just food and shelter. In 1951, the World Health Organization commissioned him to write a report which forever changed the parental visitation policies of many institutions like hospitals. Inspired by that report, another influential scientist, Harry Harlow, devised experiments involving baby macaque monkeys. In one of these experiments, he put a baby monkey into a room with two different fake or surrogate mothers. One surrogate was shaped from wire, and although it didn't resemble a monkey very much, it did have a milk bottle inside the wire. And the second surrogate looked a lot more like a monkey doll. It had a face, and it was covered in a towel-like cloth. And he wanted to see which mother the babies would prefer, the one that provides sustenance, the milk, or the one that seems to be more like a monkey. And the baby monkeys overwhelmingly preferred the cloth mother, and they would only visit the wire mother when they were hungry because the milk bottle was inside it, but they always returned to the cloth mother. And Harlow guessed that baby monkeys preferred the cloth mother, well, because it felt more like, you know, a real monkey mother, and it provided a kind of contact comfort that the wire surrogate could not. And some of Harlow's other experiments also showed how infants use the mother as a base of exploration, even with a fake surrogate mother. When an infant monkey was alone in a room or cage and something novel was placed near it, like a noise-making teddy bear, then the infant would become paralyzed by fear and huddle into a ball. But when the infant monkey was with a surrogate mother in the same situation, they would at first hide behind the mother from the noise-making teddy bear, but then they would slowly become curious and approach or even attack the novel object. Well, this of course mimics what happens with human kids too. At a playground, when a kid gets scared or hurt, they run back to mommy, who reassures them, and soon they feel calm enough to explore again. Childhood adversity comes in many forms and has many long-lasting effects. The adversity isn't just limited to maternal deprivation, although that can be a big one, but includes being abused, neglected, witnessing violence, and so on. Studies show that the more types of adversity that someone faces in childhood, the more likely they are in adulthood to have depression, anxiety, increased impulsivity, substance abuse, antisocial behavior, and violence. Here's a quote. Thus, childhood adversity can atrophy and blunt the function of the hippocampus and the frontal cortex. But it's the opposite in the amygdala. Lots of adversity and the amygdala becomes larger and hyperreactive. One consequence is increased risk of anxiety disorders. When coupled with the poor frontal cortical development, it explains problems with emotion and behavior regulation, especially impulse control. End quote. However, there is a caveat here. Many people suffer extreme adversity and still end up as very functioning adults, so keep that in mind. Although childhood adversity does make someone more likely to have certain emotional challenges later in life, none of it is guaranteed or set in stone or irreversible. And while we're talking about childhood, let's quickly discuss play too. Animals of many species play and frolic with their peers, and have you ever wondered why? Scientists say it's a powerful way for kids to learn social competence, including their place in the hierarchy, cooperation, and moral rules like fair play. One type of play that males do more often than females is what Harry Harlow called rough and tumble play, and this includes small elements of aggression, but not with the intention of causing harm. It's like when kids wrestle or puppies playfully bite each other or young lambs butt heads with each other. This kind of behavior is likely practiced for future status competitions. So, summary of this lesson. Until the 1950s, people really didn't know that maternal deprivation could cause severe health effects, including increasing kids' death rates in hospitals. And Harry Harlow showed with many baby monkey experiments the importance of a mother's warmth and presence for infant development, and that it wasn't just about food and shelter. Now lesson 8, epigenetics, how our environment influences our genes. In pop culture, genes are almost synonymous with determinism. Like, some people will see a bodybuilder with huge muscles and they'll say, oh, it's in their genes. And by that, they mean that the reason that person can build huge muscles, and they presumably can't, is because of some inherent genetic advantage. Well, as we'll explore in this lesson, the modern scientific understanding of genes is far less black and white than this. Although certain genes do determine our hair and skin color, for example, most other personal traits we have are not really caused by genes, but merely influenced by them. And our environment also plays a huge role in how our genes are ultimately expressed. In short, our genes don't determine very much, but they influence everything. First, a crash course in basic genetics. Our genes are made of long strings of DNA. I'm sure you're familiar with the iconic double helix shape of DNA. Our DNA is like a code written with a sequence of four different letters called nucleotides, and this code provides the blueprint for how to construct proteins, which are the building blocks of our bodies. Proteins make up our skin, hair, and organs, and proteins create the other molecules we need, like hormones and neurotransmitters. And you inherit half of this code of your genes from each parent. So, how exactly is our DNA code converted into actual proteins? Well, inside our cells, parts of our DNA are first photocopied to a smaller, more agile molecule called RNA, which makes it easier to manufacture proteins in different corners or parts of the cell. And after that, ribosomes read the RNA instructions and construct the proteins. So DNA makes RNA, makes proteins. And this is a central foundation of genetics. But here's a million-dollar question. How do our cells know which sections of DNA to copy and when? How do our cells know which proteins to make? You know, which section of our genes to copy at which time? Well, it's a different kind of protein called a transcription factor that regulates the whole process. You see, we have about 2,600 types of transcription factors in our bodies, which turn certain genes on or off, resulting in more or less production of specific proteins. But then, how do transcription factors know what to do? What controls or regulates transcription factors? And the answer to that throws a huge wrench into genetic determinism. It's the environment which regulates transcription factors. For example, when a mother smells her newborn child, her nose receptors send a message to the hypothalamus in the brain to activate certain transcription factors, leading to more oxytocin production, leading to milk secretion so the infant has food. And this leads us to the fascinating study of gene-environment interactions. Pop culture has long sort of repeated the idea, or oversimplification, that there is a gene for everything. A gene for depression, a gene for height, a gene for weight. What science has actually found is that the same gene can have different effects depending on your environment and upbringing. For example, there's a gene called 5-HTT that has to do with removing serotonin from synapses. And a certain type of 5-HTT gene seems to increase risk of depression, but, and here's the important part, only in people who've experienced childhood trauma. So if you have the gene and childhood trauma, your risk of depression goes up. But if you only have the gene but no trauma, your risk is no different than normal. So it's genetic, but only in certain environments. And this is the whole study, this is the whole field of epigenetics. In fact, the 5-HTT gene is a rare example of a gene that can be isolated to have some specific measurable effect. But in most cases, it's hundreds or thousands of our genes which play a role in any single trait, like our height, let alone complex behavioral traits like aggression. And this means that the individual effects of any single gene are generally very tiny and very difficult to measure. However, while scientists have found it very hard to isolate the effects of any singular gene, it is possible to study the effects of, you know, how big of an effect our genes have on us in general. And the genes that we inherit strongly affect many parts of us, including personality traits like IQ, extroversion, agreeableness, neuroticism, our risk for depression, autism, gambling, alcoholism, and schizophrenia. Scientists have found genes influence even obscure personal quirks like political involvement and texting frequency among teenagers. But how can scientists isolate the effects of genes versus environment, nature versus nurture? Well, they found some creative ways. First, identical twin studies have been very useful because identical twins share the same genes. So, for example, if we know that when one twin gets schizophrenia and 50% of the time the other one does too, then we know that schizophrenia is 50% genetically determined. Another method is to study people who were adopted at birth. So imagine there were 100 people born in Germany and then immediately sent to France and adopted by French people. Well, then by studying those people and the differences between them and the biological Germans raised in Germany, we can get some insight into the effects of genes versus environment. And finally, we have the Holy Grail, which is identical twins separated at birth and adopted into different households. In 1979, Thomas Bouchard at the University of Minnesota began studying twins like this, and eventually he would study over 100 pairs. And, you know, these are great because they share exactly the same genes, but different environments. So any consistent similarities can begin to be attributed to genes. So in summary, although genes influence most things about us, they don't really determine anything fully. And part of the reason for that is that our genes themselves are regulated by transcription factors, which are affected by the environment. And this leads to many genetic effects only being expressed in certain circumstances, like how having the 5-HTT gene can increase depression risk only in people who've experienced childhood trauma. So how do scientists know what things are caused by genes or environment? Well, they do it by studying the similarities and differences between identical twins, between adopted people, and the Holy Grail, identical twins adopted into separate households. Okay, now we move to lesson number 9, how genes evolved. And we'll talk about natural selection, sexual selection, and sociobiology. So again, we're following the pattern found throughout the book of taking another step back. So we just learned a little bit about how genes work, and now we step back to answer the question, well, why do we have certain genes in the first place and not others? Well, the first reason why we carry certain genes is natural selection, often, you know, called evolution. This is the natural process that happens when certain genes help us to survive and therefore are more likely to be passed along into future generations. For example, if an impala has genes for longer legs that help it to run faster, and then it can outrun the shorter-legged impalas while they're being chased by lions, well, eventually, over millions of years, those shorter-legged impalas are going to keep getting eaten by lions, and the genes, the impalas with the genes for longer legs, they'll be able to survive longer, which means they can have more babies, and in this way, you know, eventually, more babies will outnumber the babies of the short-legged impalas, and in that way, the genes for the traits to help an organism survive, like teeth, claws, or an immune system, are more likely to be passed down over generations. Just a very rough description of how evolution works. Another reason for an animal having certain genes is sexual selection. And this is a bit different. It's what attracts mates. And sometimes this can even contradict natural selection. For example, the incredibly colorful feather display of a male peacock. It's enchanting for female peacocks, but it makes the male a much more conspicuous target for predators. Okay, and now let's talk about something a bit different. The new fields of sociobiology and evolutionary psychology were founded on the stunning insight that evolution may have shaped not just physical traits, but animal behaviors as well. So one somewhat darker example of this is competitive infanticide. So in 1977, Harvard scientist Sarah Blaffer Hardy was shocked to realize that langur monkeys that she was studying in India were sometimes killing each other. Specifically, it was male adults killing infants. After eliminating other explanations for this behavior, she came up with one reasonable theory, which is this. Well, female langur monkeys live in groups with one resident breeding male, and the male is constantly being replaced. Every 27 months, he's being toppled from the dominant position by a new breeding male. So imagine that a new male has just entered a group of females and infants, and all around him are these infants that don't carry his genes, but they are taking up the energy and resources of the females, and the females who are nursing are not ovulating, so he can't breed with them and make his own babies. Well, one sort of evolutionary strategy evolved over, you know, millions of years is that killing the infants solves some of these problems. If the male waits for the infants to slowly grow up, then he might be replaced by another male before that can even happen. Now, what's even more surprising is that some female langur monkeys seem to have evolved their own behavioral strategy to counteract this. You know, they don't want their babies being killed. So scientists observed that some female langur monkeys hid their infant in a bush and then went into a kind of fake heat. So they sort of pretended to be ovulating when they actually weren't. And the new male sees this and he breeds with them. And tomorrow, when he sees her carrying a baby, he assumes that it's his, because he remembered, oh, I already brooded with her, the infant must be mine. And so, in this way, some of the infants can be spared from this infanticide. It's pretty interesting, these complicated behavioral strategies probably evolved through evolution, right? And competitive infanticide has now been observed in 119 other species, including lions and hippos. In fact, chimp females will sometimes kill infants of unrelated females too. And we've all heard that you're not supposed to put a male hamster in a cage with hamster babies because he's genetically programmed to kill them. All right, so now let's talk about a different kind of behavior. When it comes to mating and parenting, scientists can categorize primates as either pair bonding or tournament species. What does that mean? Well, in a pair bonding species, as the name implies, the male and female primates are mostly monogamous. The males help to raise the kids after birth, and they mostly stick, you know, with one mating partner. On the other hand, in tournament primate species, the females generally, you know, they breed with males and they take care of the kids on their own. And interestingly, only about 5% of males actually mate and pass on their genes. So males are almost competing in a kind of tournament, and a very small percentage actually mate with the females. So what's very interesting is in pair bonding species, the males and females look very similar, the same size, weight, and appearance. You'd have a hard time telling them apart. And this includes gibbons and most primates found in the New World, like South America. But in tournament species, males and females look very different. The males are usually much larger than females, and they mate way twice as much. The males may look different in other ways too. For example, male rhesus monkeys have large, sharp canine teeth despite being vegetarians. Male mandrill monkeys have very colorful red and blue faces that females don't have. You know, just think of Rafiki and the Lion King. And we all know the typical gorilla alpha male thumping his huge chest. And, you know, gorilla males are much larger than the females. Most old world primates like chimpanzees fit into the tournament species. And also in tournament species, the males also have much larger testicles and a higher sperm count than pair bonding species. So this kind of a large difference in appearance between the sexes of an animal species, this is called sexual dimorphism. And the more sexually dimorphic a primate species is physically, the more likely the scientists know that it's a tournament species when it comes to mating and parenting. So it's kind of incredible that you can predict so much about the social structure, the mating and parenting behaviors of a primate species with just one look at them. And this can probably be explained by the mating behaviors and how it must have evolved over time. In tournament species, the males intimidate and fight each other for mating rights. So only the very largest and strongest male ends up mating with, you know, pretty much all the females. And at the same time, the females are looking for the best genes, so they will choose the single male who appears fittest or healthiest. On the other hand, in pair bonding species, the gene survival strategy is less about acquiring the best genes and more about choosing a father who will help raise the kids. And if you have like a nurturing father, then the kids are more likely to survive anyway, even if the genes aren't from the most huge and muscular alpha male. So it's a different type of gene survival strategy. And, well, this kind of brings up an obvious but sort of sensitive question. Are humans a pair bonding or tournament species? I mean, on one hand, in almost all human species, most people get married and, you know, people are mostly choose monogamy. But on the other hand, most human societies throughout history have also tolerated polygamy and behaviors like divorce, promiscuity, cheating, and jealousy are very widespread. Well, if we look at, human sexual dimorphism, the physical differences between the sexes in humans, well, men are about 10% taller and 20% heavier than women. And this suggests that we're not totally a pair-bonding species, you know, we're not totally the same, but this difference is also not large enough to make us a tournament species either. You know, in many tournament species, the males are like twice as large as females. So we're somewhere in between. And maybe that explains why so many of us are confused and conflicted when it comes to mating, relationships, and marriage. So in summary, genes have been shaped by both natural selection and sexual selection. Genes which led to traits that helped us to survive were more likely to be passed down, as were genes for traits that were simply favored by the opposite sex. Sociobiology is the study of how genes may influence animal behaviors, like in the case of competitive infanticide. And finally, in primates, the differences between pair bonding and tournament species is reflected in both their mating and parenting behaviors, as well as their physical appearance and the sexual dimorphism between males and females. And now lesson 10, final lesson, us versus them, the neuroscience behind community, conflict, and war. In many animal species, there's a common pattern of hostility towards strangers, even of their own species. So like chimps and baboons will sometimes kill members of other groups that they encounter. And Jane Goodall was first to witness a long-term four-year war when the chimp group she was studying split into two opposing groups. And she saw things that gave her nightmares for years afterward and totally shattered her image of chimps as more peaceful and primitive humans. And human history is also full of examples of humans dividing themselves into groups of us and them, leading to violent conflicts. Of course, the first example that comes to mind for many people is the Holocaust, where Nazis defined them as being the Jewish people. Eric Hoffer, who studied the rise of mass movements like Nazism, wrote, quote, "Mass movements can rise and spread without belief in a God, but never without belief in a devil. When Hitler was asked whether he thought the Jew must be destroyed, he answered, 'No, we should have then to invent him. It is essential to have a tangible enemy, not merely an abstract one.'" And that's a quote from the book The True Believer by Eric Hoffer. We have a book summary of that book also on growth.me, so check that out. Really great book. What's more than a little discouraging is that there does seem to be some biological basis for racial bias, with slightly different brain activation being measured when someone sees photos of people of other races. Here's a quote from Behave, Robert Sapolsky's book. 50 millisecond exposure to the face of someone of another race activates the amygdala while failing to activate the fusiform face area as much as same race faces do, all within a few hundred milliseconds. Similarly, the brain groups faces by gender or social status at roughly the same speed. End quote. Now, psychologist Susan Fiske created a fascinating stereotype content model that gives more detail and insight into how people categorize others. And this model says that humans generally stereotype outgroups along two dimensions, warmth and competence. So warmth means, do these people mean to help or hurt me? And competence means, how effective are these people getting at what they want? So researchers found these dimensions by analyzing, you know, common stereotypes people have in many different countries. So for example, some groups are often stereotyped as low in warmth but high in competence. This might include rich people, Jewish or Asian people, and with these groups, people tend to feel envy. Other groups are perceived as low in warmth and low in competence, and this includes the poor, homeless, and welfare recipients. With these groups, people tend to feel the emotion of disgust. And next, we have groups that are seen as high in warmth but low in competence, like elderly and disabled, and these groups are associated with pity. And finally, we have the groups of high warmth and high competence, which, you know, people usually perceive as their own group and as us. And this is associated with pride. So when hate, hostility, and violence occurs between groups, it's almost always directed toward those perceived as along that dimension of low warmth, those who cause feelings of envy or disgust. For example, during the Cultural Revolution in China in the 1960s, the intellectual, artistic, and religious elites were publicly humiliated and sent to labor camps. In Nazi Germany, it was the Jews who were both envied and hated, used as scapegoats for Germany's economic problems and loss of World War I, portrayed as greedy moneylenders, and then the Jewish people were captured and sent to work themselves to death through slow starvation. I mean, contrast that to how the Nazis treated the people they perceived as high in warmth, low in competence, like the disabled or mentally ill people. Those were not humiliated, but they were quietly put to sleep inside hospitals. So, envy and resentment can be a strong emotion that can be stoked by propagandists, leading to violent results. Now, the emotion of disgust is also very commonly associated with outgroups or enemies. Now, what is disgust? Well, it's the feeling you get when part of your brain called the insula activates. Like, for example, when you bite into rotten food. And disgust seems to be like a defense against pathogens. When people are shown pictures of drug addicts or homeless people, this disgust part of the brain activates, the insula. And disgust can also be hijacked by propagandists to create more division, hatred, and violence towards a defined group. In 1994, the Rwandan genocide occurred, and over 1 million people of the Tutsi minority were brutally murdered with machetes. And it's no accident that for a long time before the machetes came out, many radio stations run by the Hutu majority group constantly referred to the Tutsis as cockroaches. When most people see a cockroach, they want to get rid of one as fast as possible. So connecting a certain ethnic group with cockroaches is a fast way to make people feel disgusted by them, leading to violent impulses. And the Tutsis were also kind of a minority that that before had often held the position of power over the Hutus. You know, there was kind of a herdsman and farmer dichotomy split between the two groups. So there was envy combined with, you know, this stoking of disgust and terrible consequence. Now, it's interesting that social conservatives have been measured to feel more disgust more easily. One study found that if you put people into a room with a stinky garbage can, they become more socially conservative. In fact, Leon Kass was the head of George W. Bush's bioethics panel, which was also very anti-abortion, even restricting stem cell research. He argued for the wisdom of repugnance, saying that disgust can be a deep and wise moral intuition. Here's a quote from the book. "People with the strongest negative attitudes towards immigrants, foreigners, and socially deviant groups tend to have the lowest thresholds for interpersonal disgust. For example, they are more resistant to wearing a stranger's clothes or sitting in a warm seat just vacated," end quote. All right, so lots of stuff there. Let's finish this summary on a lighter note, which is this. Just as people can be provoked to feel more negative, envious, disgusted, hateful, and divided toward, you know, a defined outside group, they can also be encouraged to feel more connected and united with others too. And some methods have been found to decrease the biases that people have toward those perceived as others, even as enemies. For example, using a method called individuation. You see, people generally instinctively see us as a bunch of individuals, but them are a homogeneous threatening mass. You know, they are seen as all the same. And to counter this, we can invite someone or invite ourselves to see an outgroup member as an individual. For example, when seeing a homeless person, we can think, what kind of food might they enjoy? And this will make us start to think of them more as an individual and lessen that automatic stereotyping, you know, seeing them as just a member of a group and that they're all alike. There's another method called contact theory. And in the 1950s, psychologist Gordon Allport believes that with the right kind of contact between groups, that can lessen biases. But the contact must be the right kind to work. Both groups must be treated equally, you know, on neutral ground, and differences in age, education, wealth, and skill must be minimized. Also, the groups should not compete, but be working together towards a common goal on neutral territory. For example, a 2003 study found that white athletes who played team sports with black teammates, like basketball or football, reported less prejudice than those who played individual sports, like swimming or track. So another way that this contact theory can work. And finally, I'll share one of the most inspiring examples of people uniting despite the group definitions imposed on them. Well, it's well documented that in times of war, enemy soldiers sometimes fraternize with each other, exchanging news or bartering cigarettes. During World War I, trench warfare, informal agreements of mutual restraint often happened spontaneously, and this means both sides avoided bombing easy targets like latrines or wagons delivering food. Why? Well, the soldiers from both sides were actually in the same boat, miserable and muddy, and they didn't want life to be any worse than it already was, which is what would happen with, you know, ruthless bombings. So many soldiers actually wrote in their journals about the respect they had for the tough soldiers on the other side, perhaps more respect than they had for their own commanding officers who stood way behind the front lines and the conniving politicians which had sent them to war. The most infamous of these informal agreements was the Christmas Truce of 1914, when French, German, and English soldiers all spontaneously decided to stop fighting at the same time. They crossed trenches, held joint funeral services, exchanged food and souvenirs, sang carols together, and played football with each other. In the midst of years of violence, it was a beacon of peace. So, summary of this lesson. Both nature and human history are full of examples of groups violently fighting with perceived strangers and outside groups. It can even be measured that people have slightly different brain activation when they see other race faces. And propagandists often stir up emotions of envy and disgust toward out groups before large violence breaks out, as happened during the Holocaust with Jews portrayed as greedy moneylenders and, you know, likened to animals like rats, or during the 1994 Rwandan genocide with the Tutsis often called cockroaches. On a lighter note, people can also have lessened biases through methods like individuation and neutral contact, and even in the midst of war, enemy soldiers sometimes befriend and respect each other. All right, so that's all for this note. We covered so much territory in this book by Robert Sapolsky, again, Stanford professor of biology and neurology, and you'll probably want to listen to this again to really soak in a lot more of these ideas. And let me just recommend a couple books that you might be interested. Atomic Habits by James Clear. That's a book summary that we have. And if you're interested in sort of how to form better habits, in tips that are firmly grounded in neurology, in psychology studies, then that book is a great one to check out. That's Atomic Habits by James Clear. Check our summary for that. If you found some parts of at the end interesting about, you know, World War II and why mass movements happen, then definitely check out the book summary, The True Believer by Eric Hoffer. That is a great book. It talks about how Nazism and communism and religious movements are formed and spread. Okay, so hope you enjoyed this one, and I'll see you in the next one.